Hello everyone, I'm Harry Bucknell. Thank you for downloading this special podcast on the Korean War from ABF, the Soldiers' Charity. After the surrender of Japan on the 15th of August 1945, at the end of the Second World War, Korea was divided at the 38th parallel into two zones of occupation. The Soviets administered the northern half and the Americans administered the southern half. In 1948, as a result of Cold War tensions, the occupation zones became two sovereign states, a socialist North under Kim Il-sung and a capitalist South under Syngman Rhee. Neither accepted the border as permanent. On the 25th of June 1950, the North Korean People's Army, the KPA, crossed the border into South Korea. The United Nations Security Council, formed in April 1945, denounced the North Korean move as an invasion and authorized the formation of the United Nations Command to repel it, led by General Douglas MacArthur and the armed forces of President Truman's United States. Decisions taken without the participation of Stalin's Soviet Union or the embryonic People's Republic of China under Mao Zedong, both of whom supported North Korea. This week, as we remember the 70th anniversary of the Battle of the Imjin River, in which 29 Commonwealth Brigade fought so valiantly, in particular the 1st Battalions of the Gloucester Regiment, the Royal Ulster Rifles, the Royal Northumberland Fusiliers, and the tanks of the 8th King's Royal Irish Hussars. This programme is dedicated to the 21 countries of the United Nations who fought the North Korean aggression, especially the 1st Commonwealth Division, formed by elements from Great Britain, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, India and South Korea, who combined to fight in a war of over 3 million combatants, leaving 1.2 million dead, over 500,000 missing, 1 million wounded, and an estimated 2 to 3 million civilians killed. I'm holding in my hand two pieces of paper. A5 in size, they are done in colour. Along the top are printed the words Post Office Telegram, with a King's Crown at centre. They are franked Alderbury, Salisbury, Wilts, and banded at the back by brown taping, now frail to the touch. Written in pencil, transmitted at 4:23 p.m. on the 28th of September, 1950. The transcript reads, "From War Office, London, OHMS. Deeply regret to inform you that a report from overseas states that your son has been missing in operations in Korea since 20th Sept 1950. Stop. The Army Council desire to offer their sympathy in your anxiety. Stop. Letter follows. Stop. Under Secretary of State for War. Ends." Just one of many telegrams that notified families up and down the land of the 1,078 British servicemen and women killed in action, the 2,674 wounded, and the 1,060 either missing or taken prisoner, a significant number of whom were reservists summoned back to fight or national servicemen called up for duty. For many, Korea was and remains a forgotten war. At the outset of hostilities in June 1950, there was the notion that it would all be over by Christmas. Sir Max Hastings.
MacArthur was a man of boundless arrogance, and he was absolutely convinced that a bunch of gooks or Chinese laundrymen or whatever were not going to stop American troops. And so there was an expectation that when they rushed the first American troops into Korea in June 1950, that they would very soon sort out these gooks. And of course, everybody then called the North Korean, they called all Koreans a gook. And it wasn't like that. I've interviewed members of Task Force Smith, the first American force that met the North Koreans in June 1950. And they got the shock of their lives when they see these North Korean tanks coming down the road and they start firing their old World War II bazookas. And of course, the rockets bounce off, because 2.35 rockets were just not up to it against T-34 tanks. the Americans also broke and fled, and it was a very near thing in June 1950 that the North Koreans did not simply drive the Americans, these small American forces, out of the whole of Korea. And what would have happened if they'd been driven out of the whole peninsula is very hard to be sure. As it was, the North Korean assault ran out of steam around the Nakdong River in the southeast corner of Korea. And the Americans were just able to form a perimeter, what they call the Pusan perimeter, around the port of Pusan. And into Pusan, they rushed troops, including the 1st British contingent, 27th Brigade from Hong Kong, including token forces of Australians and Canadians and Indians and such like, because this was allegedly a UN commitment. These people were just able to hold the line during the so-called siege of the Busan perimeter.
I suppose, especially in today's context of a sort of post-European Britain, was that this was a Commonwealth Brigade, and it came under Australian command as a divisional commander. What was the state of the post-war British Army in 1950 at that time?
In 1950, both the American and the British armies were incredibly run down. And I always remember an American general who had fought in both Korea and Vietnam said to me, he said, "We went into Korea with a lousy army and we came out with a very good one." He said, "We went into Vietnam with a very good army and came out with a terrible one." And it's a terrible humiliation for people that they felt in 1945 under Churchill's leadership, they felt, here we were only 5 years earlier, we were the winners. We defeated evil. We were right up there with America and Russia. We were the victors in the greatest war the world has ever seen. And now, 5 years later, here we were on our knees and the Americans getting richer by the minute.
In 1950, however, the post-war British and US armies were in a poor state. Max Hastings again.
When they started putting together forces, because they sent 27th Brigade from Hong Kong to the Busan perimeter, but they then put together 29 Brigade in Britain to follow them. And when they were putting together that brigade, it was a pathetic business. They were dragging out of mothballs all this equipment, all these guns, all these jeeps. Getting the vehicles to start was quite an enterprise. There was a shocking story about the reservists. In order to fill the ranks of 29 Brigade, they had to mobilize a lot of reservists. And for God knows what reason, probably just mere incompetent bureaucracy, quite a lot of the reservists whom they picked on to join this force to go to Korea have been prisoners of war in the Second World War. And some stupid bureaucrat must have thought that meant they'd had a soft option, that they'd sat behind wire doing nothing for 4 or 5 years. But actually, these poor traumatized men were, of course, they'd had ghastly experiences, and yet here they were put back into uniform and told that they got to go to Korea. And one of the most shocking things that happened later when 29 Brigade got into trouble was that there were men taken prisoner by the North Koreans and the Chinese who then went into prison camps who'd already done time, not only in German prison camps, but in Japanese prison camps. And to put those men through that ordeal again was a terrible thing to do. One officer I spoke to who'd been with 29 Brigade, and he described a mother turning up with her literally screaming kids at the guardhouse at Colchester Barracks and saying to some hapless junior officer, saying, "You take them, you take these kids. What am I supposed to do when you're taking my husband to go off to Korea?" And it was a shocking business. One of the things that also caused a lot of grief to the men who fought in Korea, and this went especially for the British, was that in World War II, or even the Falklands, everybody knew where the families were. Everybody knew where the fighting men were. Everybody knew why they were at war. Korea, two-thirds of the British people had no idea. They had no idea where Korea was, even when the war had been going on for a year or two. And they certainly had no idea why we were involved. And a lot of veterans I've interviewed described their pain of getting letters from home saying, "The neighbors are all wondering if you've left me," because they've no idea, they don't believe there is such a thing as Korea or the war and so on. And it's very hard to be risking your life every day in conditions of dreadful discomfort if what you're doing is not appreciated back home. And no, it was not appreciated back home.
It is a parallel you could draw with the recent Afghanistan campaign, I suppose, in that respect.
It is always a truth that, I don't mean to make it the Falklands sound a pushover, but when the Falklands War was being fought, the whole country was watching every second of it all. All the men returned as heroes. Well, the men who went to Korea, not only was they feel that nobody was watching, but when they went home, nobody even noticed they'd been away.
In terms of kit and equipment, this was like a sort of bridge between sort of then and now in that sense, because we had the new Centurion tank, which had a self-stabilizing gun, which seemed to be a great boon. And of course, this was the first time that napalm was introduced into warfare, wasn't it?
Yeah, the first napalm was used in war for the first time in 1950. And I remember how tremendously impressed British veterans I spoke to were by seeing it. They said we weren't quite sure how much actual practical use it was because it was landing all over the place, but it was totally good for morale to see these sheets of flame going up. The British sent the best men and kit that they had, but they were still immensely dependent for a kit on the Americans to supply an awful lot of stuff.
John Preston Bell, now 91, recalls that he joined the 8th Hussars because he liked the adjutant's hat.
I hadn't thought about which regiment I wanted to join. I didn't know one regiment from another. I'd just come straight from the school. I'd assumed that when I was ordained or made an officer, I'd be sent to some regiment the army would send me to. It so happened that morning we'd just come off parade, first thing in the morning, and the officer who took the adjutant was wearing a funny hat. And I said to one of the other chaps, I said, "What's with the hat?" And he, obviously knowing more than I did, he said, "Oh, he's an 8th Hussar." And 8th Hussar was the only regimental name that I could cause in my frozen mind at that moment. And that was put down, and they went on and trained. Then, of course, 6 weeks later, the Korean War broke out, and the 8th Hussars were part of the Fire Brigade, I think we were called, 29th Brigade, which was a small army, in effect, ready to go wherever it was needed. And the adjutant called me into his office and said, "I see you put your name down for my regiment." I said, "Yes." "Of course, you're never going to Korea." I managed to gasp out, "No, sir." And he very kindly said, "Well, go and take a weekend pass and discuss it with your parents. Come and see me Monday morning."
John Keatley, 87, volunteered for active service with the Duke of Wellington's regiment.
We were all asked to say where we wanted to go, and we had to put down, I think, three places. One of mine was Korea, and so obviously volunteer is better than the forced man. And I received my papers to join the Duke of Wellington's, who are going to Korea. That's how that happened. My elder brother did his national service, and he spent it in Gibraltar. And I thought that was a complete waste of time. So I thought, well, I must use the time to my best advantage. And that's why I wanted to go to Korea. I just didn't want to waste 2 years or whatever in the army, doing nothing but marching up and down again.
Aged just 18, George Brown, now 87, from Westminster, was learning to be a mechanic. But the former Buckingham Palace newspaper boy found himself trained to be a soldier in Northern Ireland.
When I got called up, 18, I thought they might put me in the Royal Engineers or something like that. But no, unless you was an apprentice, they found a job for you, and they watched the infantry men. So they actually sent me to Ireland to be trained as an infantryman, and I was trained in the Inniskilling Fusiliers. Fairly accomplished one, because I became I could work the 2-inch mortar. I could also run the MMG machine gun. So I was quite a trained man. The Liverpool Regiment was already in Korea, so they needed buck up.
Tommy Clough, 90, who joined the Royal Artillery as a boy soldier in 1945, recalls his battery commander removing his much-vaunted first stripe.
Anyway, he called me in. He said, "Look," he said, I've got to take the stripe off you." I said, "Why is that? I only just got it." He said, "Well, we're calling in reservists, and we're giving them back their rank. that they left the army in. So he said, at the moment, you're surplus to establishment. So he said, don't worry, I'll give it you back later, you see. He never did, until we got back to the UK. But anyway, that's another story. And then a few weeks later, we were running around Worcester. I think the locals thought the Americans had come back, because we had jeeps and things, and we had stars on them, you know.
Yes, yes.
For recognition.
John Preston Bell remembers the new Centurion tank.
At 50 tonnes, 30-pounder main armament, the Beezer coaxially mounted. A lovely tank. We'd been trained on the Comet, and then we were issued with Centurions to go to Korea. I don't think I was sitting in a Centurion until we got to Korea, and I learned about it then a bit. And the great thing about it was it had the stabilizer so the gun could go. But it was a super tank, big, roomy, very heavy. After the Comet, it was heaven. It was surprising how steep a hill you could get the Centurion up. Just lock it in bottom gear and don't touch the steering mechanism, and just let it shunter up the hill. And you could get into surprising places. And we did actually once or twice surprise the enemy by appearing on the top of the hill and booping away at them.
By autumn 1950, the UN counteroffensive led by General MacArthur had reached the North Korean border with China. However, on the premise of fearing for its own security, China now joined the war. Max Hastings.
It was a shocking business. Because the Chinese, for a time, achieved a terrific psychological dominance, so great that MacArthur was not the only American general who started demanding from Washington that they should use nuclear weapons to even the score, as some Americans saw it. And they did not have to face much in the way of incoming heavy artillery until much later in the war.
After three offensives between October 1950 and January 1951, which pushed UN forces south and captured Seoul, MacArthur's response was to advocate the use of nuclear weapons. Max Hastings.
And then Douglas MacArthur, who had suffered a personal humiliation as a result of this defeat. There he was. He had said, we're going to go to the Chinese border. He'd said the Chinese won't dare intervene, and he was proved disastrously wrong. Now, it was also yet another huge intelligence failure, because one has to remember that it was only a year since Mao Zedong had taken over control of China, and the American media was still full of stuff about the disgraceful loss of China. A lot of the conservative media were demanding that America intervene to take back China. They got their client, Chiang Kai-shek, sitting with his army on the island of Formosa, today's Taiwan, and a lot of Americans and conservatives clamoring to put him back into China to take him back. And the Chinese calculation, which I think was not a bad calculation, was if the Americans scored a complete triumph and occupied Korea up to the Yellow River border, and you had American troops sitting on the border of China, the temptation for some of these very arrogant lunatics to go a step further and get back into China and try and take back China would be irresistible. Now, whether or not this would really have happened, we don't know. But this is how Mao Zedong thought. And Mao Zedong thought he could not allow the Americans to take the whole of Korea and to be sitting there with strong forces on his border, commanded by a man as arrogant as MacArthur. Thus, he sneaked all these troops back in. But he sent a lot of diplomatic warnings through Indian intermediaries and so on to the Americans, saying that China would not stand for having American forces on the Yellow River border. And they were ignored in Washington because MacArthur in particular, MacArthur, a man of such stupendous, he really almost thought he was a god. And when his own troops had sailed up to through North Korea in September and October of 1950, he thought this was just a victory march. There they were, come Thanksgiving, having turkey and cranberry sauce distributed to the American troops. And suddenly, all these Chinese appear out of nowhere, and his beloved army is fleeing for its life down south. And it was known, it became known in American army parlance as the big bugger, that you had people just literally fleeing for their lives down the road with the Chinese behind them. Many American veterans have said to me it was one of the most shameful and shocking spectacles they've ever seen in November and December of 1950. And it was MacArthur in his outraged arrogance that these wretched gooks, these laundrymen, had dared to do this to him. Didn't they know who he was? He was MacArthur, the emperor, the god. And thus it was, he made it plain that he favored dropping a couple of nukes on China just to show everybody who was really boss here. Yeah. And Harry Truman, the president, I think absolutely correctly and with great courage, as a result, sacked MacArthur in April 1951. It cost Harry Truman his job, ultimately, because a lot of the American people who did agree that MacArthur was a god, they thought Truman was completely wrong to sack him. In 1952, Harry Truman didn't dare make a second run for president because he knew he'd be beaten. And it was really the sacking of MacArthur that caused many Americans to decide that Harry Truman was not the sort of guy they wanted in charge. And I think Harry Truman was a very great president. And I think his decision to sack Truman, and of course it should be said, the British were absolutely appalled by MacArthur. Attlee, the prime minister, flew to Washington explicitly to warn the president and to warn the US government that the British wanted no part of any threats to use atomic weapons in the Korean War. The British didn't really want any part of the Korean War at all, but the British recognized that for the solidarity of the alliance, they had to stay there, but they weren't happy about it.
By the end of February 1951, the UN launched a series of offensive operations, recapturing Seoul on the 15th of March, pushing the front line back northwards. By the 22nd of April, the front, following the Lower Imjin River, was held by the United States Army's First Corps. Comprising from west to east, the South Korean Republic of Korea Army, 1st Division, the US 3rd Division with the attached British 29th Brigade, and the US 25th Division with attached Turkish Brigade and the US 24th Division. The 29th Brigade was commanded by Brigadier Tom Brodie, consisting of the 1st Battalion of the Gloucester Regiment under command of Lieutenant Colonel James Kahn, the 1st Battalion of the Royal Northumberland Fusiliers, under Lieutenant Colonel Kingsley Foster, the 1st Battalion, the Royal Ulster Rifles, under temporary command of Major Gerald Rickord, and the Belgian Battalion, under Lieutenant Colonel Albert Crahay, to which Luxembourg's contribution to the UN forces was also attached. The brigade was supported by 25-pounders of 4-5 Field Regiment Royal Artillery, commanded by Lieutenant Colonel M.T. Young, the 4.2-inch mortars of 170 Independent Mortar Battery Royal Artillery, the Centurion tanks of C Squadron, 8th King's Royal Irish Hussars, under the command of Major Henry Huth, and by 55 Squadron, Royal Engineers. Max Hastings.
You've got these three British battalions and a Belgian battalion, all spread out over a very big area. I think it was about 12 miles. And actually, that size force should have been defending a perimeter of about a mile or a mile and a half. But there they were, and secondly, they were not well dug in or wired. And when I said to an officer, why weren't you properly wired? He said, well, we weren't expecting to be attacked. We were expecting to advance. And the basic principle of all defensive actions is obstacles covered by fire. You can achieve miracles. But in this case, you did not have the obstacles covered by fire. That the Chinese had a clear run, no minefields, no wire, none of the rest of it. And most significantly of all, no air support, because they didn't have forward air controllers with them. I mean, there's this huge American and Allied air forces are in Korea, but they got no means to call them in. They got a bit of air support, but nothing significant. And equally, they weren't getting heavy artillery support. They were reliant on 25-pounders. And the British bang on generation after generation, 25-pounder, great gun, wonderful gun, and so on. Well, it was a wonderful gun, but it was a little gun, and it's not a killing gun.
Meanwhile, and unbeknown to the United Nations Command, General Peng, Commander-in-Chief of the Chinese and North Korean forces in the field, has stately planned to capture Seoul as a May Day gift to Mao Zedong. Tommy Clough, in the Forward Observation Officer's Party, responsible for directing fire of 170 batteries, 4.2-inch mortars, picks up the story.
On the night of the 22nd of April, Colonel Kahn sent a 12-man patrol down to the river with orders that if any Chinese did come across, to try and snatch a prisoner to get some intelligence, you see. So they went down, a second lieutenant, Guy Temple, in charge of this patrol. All he'd had was instructions that if it was more than 30, not to take them on, to withdraw, and at the same time try and get a prisoner. They were there probably 4 or 5 hours, and then in the wee small hours, in darkness, they heard voices. So they sent a flare up, and there were Chinese in the river trying to pull across, you see.
What is your recollection of Colonel Khan, who won the Victoria Cross in this action?
I met him a few times, and he had a reputation, because his nickname was Cool Khan, and he had a reputation for not using more than 2 words where 12 words would have been better. He was very taciturn, you know, he wasn't very talkative. The brigade were outnumbered, and we were being pushed back. So the Northumberlands, the Ulster Rifles, and the Belgian battalion got out at great cost. We dug in. In fact, Colonel Khan had already sent people up there to dig slit trenches ready for us. They used to attack mainly at night, and that was the trouble, because you couldn't see the so-and-sos then. But when they came in during the day, we were just raking them, killing them. I mean, they'd come in waves. The first wave would get killed, mown down. The second wave would come in and pick up their weapons and use them, you know. And we always thought there were three things driving them. Either they were very brave, or they were drugged, or there were people behind driving them on, because we got the feeling, and this was verified later, that most of the Chinese troops were nationalists that had been caught by the communists. So we've got a feeling that most of those cannon fodder...
Before they came, there was this great noise of bugles in the sky.
Yes. Well, that's it, you see, because they didn't have radios at that level, they coordinated their attacks by bugles or whistles, and you knew they were coming. You know, we used to sit there, and a couple of the lads would be asleep or something, snatching sleep when you could,
yeah.
And then the bugles would start. So you'd get your rifle, you'd be ready for them, because you knew they were coming. There was no real tactics. There was no thought to what they were doing.
Just thousands and thousands and thousands of Chinese.
Yes. And 45th Field, who were outside, firing from miles away, they were brilliant. I mean, I saw British infantry at its best, but I also saw British Army gunnery at its best. They were absolutely magnificent, because we had their foos with us, and they were more or less directing fire onto our position, you know.
So the story goes that Anthony Farahocky, then the adjutant of 1st Battalion of the Gloucesters, got hold of the drum major and said, "Drum major, give them some calls back."
Yeah.
Do you remember that moment?
I do indeed. He said, "Play everything but retreat." And that's what he did. And unfortunately, I think it riled the Chinese, because they were very silent for about half an hour afterwards. We didn't hear a thing. And then they came at us twice as hard, you know, because they knew we were taking the piss out of them.
Good for you, Tommy. Yeah. So here we are. You've got no water. You're very low on food. Presumably no food at all, probably. You're very, very low on ammunition.
Yes.
The first few days, it must have been like a turkey shoot. You were just taking them out,
taking them out.
And the brave Gloucesters were holding that hill. And that must have been a great sort of feeling of camaraderie.
Oh, there was.
You're there amongst them.
And people say to me, How did you manage? How did you hold together? And it was a question of army discipline and camaraderie. You didn't want to let your mates down, you know. We held the main base. We held Battalion HQ. And we just kept mowing them down.
What are your recollections of Captain Farrah Hockley in this action?
Farrah Hockley was a supreme. He was a soldier's soldier. And the men, the Gloucesters, although he was a strong disciplinarian in barracks, the men thought the world of him.
Max Hastings.
It was a mess. One of the things the British tend to do is we do like to glamorize and glorify our defeats, our massive cock-ups. Now, in one sense, it's right to do so, because, for instance, in the Indian River Battle, a lot of British soldiers fought extremely bravely, and a lot of British soldiers have died doing very brave things, so you'd start that. But nonetheless, the battle was a cock-up from start to finish, and ought to be taught in staff colleges to this day as an example how not to do things. The first problem was psychological, that brigade was expecting very shortly to join an advance across the Indian River and heading north. They were not expecting to be attacked. The intelligence was very poor. They knew nothing about what was happening on the other side of the Indian and got the shock of their lives when they sent a fighting patrol across the river and bumped into a lot of Chinese. And that was the first inkling they had that they might be into something serious, but the intelligence was woeful. Secondly, they've got a huge perimeter to defend. And the great principle is if you try and defend everything, you defend nothing.
The Gloucesters valiantly held off wave after wave of enemy attack, but heavily outnumbered, were caught on Hill 235. Attempts to supply the battalion by airdrop were unsuccessful. Despite their difficult situation, the battalion held their ground. Colonel Khan, the commanding officer, and Lieutenant Curtis winning the Victoria Cross in the intense fighting. On the morning of the 25th of April, 4-5 Field Regiment could no longer provide artillery support. Without food or water or ammunition, Khan gave the order to his company commanders to make for the British lines as best as they could. Tommy Clough.
It was probably the only time I was really badly scared. But at the same time, when it was finished and their casualties were obvious, it was so exhilarating, you know, to know that my gunners, my regiment, had done their job. And I was very, very proud to be a gunner. I mean, the Gloucesters, obviously, were very proud to be infantry on that occasion, because they were able to hold the Chinese off. But of course, as the attacks came in, on the last day, on the 24th, things were getting desperate. We knew that a relief column wasn't coming. We knew we had to get out sooner or later because we were running short of ammunition. We couldn't hold them back any longer. And we were throwing rocks at them, literally throwing rocks.
So you were effectively now involved in escape and evasion, as it were.
Yeah.
You coming down from the hill, this is during the night time?
No, it was 10 o'clock in the morning. I can remember it clearly. We'd been ordered at 8 o'clock in the morning by the brigadier. Khan was given permission to try and break out. I saw everybody going. I thought, right, I'm going with you, you know. We eventually caught them up. And as we did, he said, spread out, spread out. So we spread out. We started to go up a small rise in the undergrowth. And suddenly I saw a Chinaman stand up. And by his side, it was all happening in seconds, but by his side was a light machine gunner. And this Chinaman standing up was pointing down. So I raised my rifle and I fired. And that's when I got this Chinaman. He went down and they both disappeared. And they'd been specially sent to head us off. And that was it. I heard a voice behind, and I'm pretty certain it was Farrah Hockley's. saying, right, lads, put your armour down, put your rifles down, this is it. And then, of course, they hounded us together.
What did you feel at that moment, that you were captured, the moment that it was all up, as it were, the game was over?
Well, it was quite a disappointment, because, to be honest, I thought we might have made it out. But anyway, the thing is then, we just started to worry about what the Chinese would do to us, because we didn't know their attitude. And they weren't too bad. They were frontline troops, and we were frontline troops. So they weren't too bad, except they wanted our watches and everything like that, you know. But I hid my watch.
I shan't ask where.
John Preston Bell remembers the Centurion tanks, the Beth Hussars, driving up to help the Dossers as they escaped.
Well, the last day, when we went up to get the infantry out or to escort them out, and Henry took half the squadron up the western track to try and get the Gloucesters out, but they were unable to get through. There was an impassable pass. And I went under Peter Ormerod, second in command, to get the Northumberland Fusiliers and the Ulster Rifles out, and we escorted them back for 6 miles. They must have been exhausted. There had been 3 days and nights without food and water, and they ran out of ammunition. They ran out of everything in the end. They didn't have any sleep for 3 nights, and the Chinese kept coming.
Was their morale good?
I think so, yes. They were just dead tired. But there was a bit of banter, but there wasn't much time for talk anyway. They climbed on the backs of the tanks, those who could, and we were facing south. I traversed the gun to face north, because that's where the enemy seemed to be coming from. And then the men were sitting and lying on the back of the engine covers. So I just depressed the gun and gave them a bit of cover. So I couldn't actually use my armament at all. So I stood on my seat, head out of the turret, waving a carbine around. And then the first bullet pinged off the turret ring beside me. And, well, it's a good example of how inexperienced I was. I was just a schoolboy in uniform, really. And when I saw that bullet ping off, I just leant round the hatch cover, which was upright behind me, and I leant round and said, "Yeah, I missed!" And then it slowly realised that, you know, that things were actually quite serious, and the next one might not. So at that point I closed the hatch and really did no more than observe through the
periscope.
At that moment there was a pang of fear. Although I have to say, in my own defence, I didn't actually feel frightened apart from that. There was an awful lot happening, very noisy, and it was all very exciting, and twice the tank nearly was disabled, and twice I knew that we were going to have to get out and get shot. But the tank was not disabled. But we had that awful moment when a stone gets under the back of the track and it jumps half off the sprocket. The tank stalls. The driver gets into neutral, starts it up again, puts it into gear, and as soon as he starts to operate the clutch, the thing comes right off. Mm. And on this occasion, it went back on. And, I mean, it had happened to me once before, it had come off, and I knew it was going to happen again. And that was a very remarkable moment. I had said to God, "Sorry, I haven't made a better fist of life so far, but thanks all the same." And at that moment, I knew we were going to get killed in a couple of minutes, and one was ready for it. But there isn't time to be frightened. Somehow you're just... I mean, I'm speaking as if I'm a battle-hardened veteran. I'm not. I was, as I say, a schoolboy. in uniform on manoeuvres. But gosh, they're using real bullets.
Max Hastings.
Some people today, because Korea is the forgotten war, as it's often described, some people say, was it worth it? I believe it was. I do believe that in the climate of those times, that the Korean War enabled the West, and chiefly America and Britain, to demonstrate to communists that in the face of naked aggression, they were prepared to fight, and they were prepared to fight effectively. And it was a bloody business, and it was a joyless business, and almost nobody who fought in Korea enjoyed the experience, partly because the climate was so terrible, and partly because nobody back home seemed to appreciate it. But I do believe that the sacrifices made in Korea by British soldiers, as well as by American, were not in vain. I think it did serve a purpose.
After Imjin, the battle lines became more static, but the fighting no less ferocious. Sir William Purvis, 89, then a platoon commander with the 1st Battalion, the King's Own Scottish Borderers, describes the engagement around Hill 355, Little Gibraltar, on Guy Fawkes Night, 1951. A battle in which Bill Speakman won the VC and Purvis became the only second lieutenant to be awarded a Distinguished Service Order.
The attack was quite a surprise. The numbers of troops involved, yelling and shouting and screaming as they came forward. I was on a small pinnacle with 30 men and another platoon from another company behind me. And we didn't get the initial rush of men that other companies had. The fighting started just at darkness, went on for some time, but apart from my pinnacle and the bit immediately behind, I'm afraid the rest of the battalion was overrun. Communications, of course, were very poor in those days. The old 88 wireless set didn't really work in the mountains. So our own artillery put down a big strike all along the front as positions were lost, including the one I was on, and we suffered a number of casualties because of that, including a little shrapnel that I caught myself. But we stayed there until early the following morning, 2 a.m., with sporadic small attacks on our position, until I was ordered to try and withdraw, which wasn't the easiest thing to do in the middle of the night, of course.
If I may interject, sir, I think you make rather light of the situation. You had 13 wounded at the time. If I may say, you refer to some shrapnel in your arm. Your shoulder was severely injured and you were losing a lot of blood. Is that fair to say?
Well, I don't think I lost too much blood, but yes, there was a bit of blood around, of course. And I was very fortunate. We had some Korean bearers who helped. And I also very luckily had two stretchers on the position, so the worst wounded we were able to take out. But we had to go down a very steep hill through woods in what was not quite total darkness. So the withdrawal was probably the most difficult thing to do. But we got down there and rejoined some of our rear party, and I was able to hand over the other platoon to D Company, because the platoon commander had been injured rather badly. And we eventually got down just as the sun was starting to come up.
What point did you realize that you were basically you had engaged with the point section of the point platoon, of the point company, of a point battalion, of a point brigade, point division of an enormous army against you?
Well, I think that realization of what I'd been in came much later, when I was probably recovering and being sent. I was evacuated to Japan, as most of our wounded were. One became more aware of just the enormity of the Guy Fawkes Day, as we called it.
When you got the order to get out of it from your commanding officer, and the great KOSB, I can imagine, fought like lions. You had 13 wounded, you had to get them, you got all the 40 men out and all the wounded, and all your arms and ammunition. That was quite some feat under such difficult circumstances. What was going through your mind in arranging and organizing this? You've been all over the platoon position all night long, keeping the men going. What was your thoughts at that time?
I mean, it seemed to be just duty. I wasn't really aware of and thinking too much about it. One must remember that the 19-year-old National Service officer had had a very good training at Eton Hall, and we were just trained to command 30 men, and including tricky situations, battlefield training and the like. So it was quite a shock to get to Korea.
John Keatley, 87, then serving as a platoon commander with the 1st Battalion, the Duke of Wellington's regiment, talks about the Third Battle of the Hook in May 1953.
For about 10 days or more, we were told that there was going to be a Chinese attack. Now, obviously, we didn't know how that was going to happen or how our battalion knew about it. But what had happened is that there was a deserter from the Chinese, and he told our battalion, brigade, whoever was involved, that an attack was imminent. And so the cry was each night, tonight's the night. And we were on alert. Well, I didn't know what was happening because I was with the pioneers on the reverse slope of the hook. The barrage came down onto the hook. And it was said to be more concentrated than anything in the Second World War, analogous much more to the First World War in terms of bombardment. I was first alerted to it when there was a tremendous bombardment, and I immediately got on my wireless and asked what was going on, and was told the Chinese were attacking. But then the line was cut, because the physical line, the telephone line, as opposed to the wireless, is the first casualty in any bombardment, because the wires run down the trenches. And if a shell falls into a trench, it cuts the telephone lines. You know all these American films where the platoon commander shouts orders to his men. It's quite impossible with the shore under bombardment, because your voice cannot be heard. So I went round, immediately I knew about this, I went round to my men who were in the trenches. My headquarters was behind the trenches. And I went forward and moved right along as far as the Turks, encouraging people and telling them what to look out for and so on. I did that three times during the night. The thing ended at 2 o'clock in the morning. So between 8 o'clock when it started and 2 o'clock in the morning, I was either in my headquarters on the radio to HQ, or I was out on my own going around my men. When the attack came, it came just before our people went into their trenches.
Stand to.
The Chinese, of course, observed this. They saw us going into our trenches, weapon pits and so forth. So they knew exactly how to time their attack, just as we were organising ourselves to go into our positions.
How was it when they... Can you describe your feelings as how did it all kick off?
I think it's not generally said, but I'm pretty certain that what I'm saying is correct. The battle was won by the artillery. The artillery were on the alert, just as everybody else was on the alert. They knew the battle was coming. They had the whole place registered. So when the Chinese attacked, the artillery immediately responded. And it was said, and there's no proof of this, it was said that they used airburst shells. Well, you can imagine the effect of airburst shells on massed battalion of Chinese. So very few of them got into the trenches. But they did get into the trenches, and they threw satchel charges, which satchel charge is a bomb, which you carry on your back, the Chinese carried on their back. They threw them into the tunnels in which our men were getting ready, and they capsized the entrance to the tunnels, and so imprisoning our people in their tunnels. Of course, you know, one was more or less petrified while the bombardment was going on, because one never knew when it was going to come down on oneself. And I had this responsibility, obviously, to go round my men at intervals throughout the battle. And there was a big danger then. The trenches were good. They were deep trenches. But as I went round the access trenches, of course, my eyes were looking for somebody above me. In other words, a Chinaman above me. I never saw one because they were further on. But it was a pretty hairy business. Very tiring. I have never in my life been as tired as I was the morning after the battle when we were relieved. And I went back and I slept until 12 o'clock, midnight.
What is your abiding memory of that battle?
I think it's the noise and the apprehension of what might happen to you.
After 2.5 years as a prisoner of war, including an unsuccessful escape attempt and months in solitary confinement, Tommy Clough and his fellow prisoners were released in a POW exchange as part of the peace negotiations.
Now, when we got to the camp in 1951, we just about crawled in. But when we left the camp in 53, we marched out. And we marched out singing. And the song we sang was "It's a Long Way to Tipperary," because of the Irish men that were with us. And I'll never forget that song. Every time I hear it now, I think of when we marched out of the camp, because of course, what we were thinking of mainly, really, were the lads we left behind. It's a long way to Tipperary. It's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know. Goodbye, Piccadilly. Farewell, Leicester Square.
It's a long, long way to Tipperary, but my heart's right there.
Armistice talks continued for 2 years. A problematic negotiation point was prisoner of war repatriation. Many Chinese and North Korean soldiers refusing to return home, which was unacceptable to their leadership. In 1952, the US elected a new president, former General Dwight D. Eisenhower, who went to Korea to learn what might end the war. With the United Nations' acceptance of India's proposed Korean War armistice, the Chinese, North Koreans and UN command signed the Korean Armistice Agreement on the 27th of July, 1953. The date when the war is considered to have ended, even though there was no peace treaty. For George Brown, however, 5 days earlier, there was no sign of the enemy relenting.
We thought we had a lot of noise. So we phoned back, we spoke to the guard control to that part of it. I explained to him what was happening. And he said, what makes you think there's a lot of noise? Because we've had no information. That's his words. And I said to him, well, I think that's why I'm telling you, that there is action. So he said, no, hold your positions until we know more about this. too fucking late. While I was on the phone, I did say to the young captain, I suppose he was with each other, I said to him, do you think you ought to, why don't you water the area? Which they used to put the mortars into the area when we was telling him. And he treated that as, I thought, treading on someone's toes, so that was it. We got annihilated, the four of us. I was very, very seriously wounded. And the other guys was all finished as such. And I could see it was out. I said, is that you, Edwin? He said, Brownie, is that you? I said, yes, it is, just. He said, stay there, he said. Just stay there. Anyway, I couldn't move. And he came across and he said to me, you're in the bad way, George. He said, we've got to get you out. I'll get you out of here. He got me in, and then he got someone to come in and help. So last I see of him, I was shot 14 bullet wounds in my legs. The man who saved me, I got a photograph indoors of him, Peter Adlam. He was a tough guy, because he came out and still stick with me when there was, they must have been around, you know, because they went, you know. And the chap, as a man, he died last year. There's Johnny Robertshaw, he got killed. He come from Chelsea. There was Alfie Bishop, he come from Stepney. And then we had a Liverpool bloke in there with us. And the three of them, they all got killed except me, surviving. Long after I came back and I thought about it, and I thought, I was on my feet then, I was on calipers now, and I thought, I'll have to do something to get in touch with their families. I received a message on the phone telling me, it is not a good idea. You have come back and they haven't. Would you have thought that was an answer? But I've often wanted to let them know that I was there with them.
Back in London, the postman called to Westminster.
And the postman come down and he said, Mrs. Brown, or Mrs. Brown. She said, Mrs. Brown. He said, I've got a telegram for you. He said, have you got anybody there with you who would open the telegram for you? Which rather... this has only been explained to me, Arthur. So she said, well, there's Celia here, which is the girl. So he gave it to her. He said, will you open it and explain it? Of course, in there, he told her how seriously ill I was and how dangerous I am. And Celia Burton read it to my mum. I often said to my mum after, I said, she said, I couldn't take it in. Nobody comes and knocks on your door with a telegram to tell you that your son who you're hoping is out in Korea or in a war or something, and all of a sudden you get a guy coming down to tell you that he could have been dead, couldn't I? You know what I mean, the telegram.
Just as George's mother received her dreaded news in London, so our story comes full circle. The telegram I made mention of at the beginning of the programme reporting a soldier missing was to my grandfather, whose son, Geoffrey Bucknell, serving with 1st Battalion, the Middlesex Regiment, was the first British officer killed in the Korean War. He was the uncle I never knew. Historian Sir Max Hastings.
Some people today, because Korea is the forgotten war, as it's often described, some people say, was it worth it? I believe it was. I do believe that in the climate of those times, that the Korean War enabled the West, and chiefly America and Britain, to demonstrate to communists that in the face of naked aggression, they were prepared to fight, and they were prepared to fight effectively. And it was a bloody business, and it was a joyless business, and almost nobody who fought in Korea enjoyed the experience, partly because the climate was so terrible, and partly because nobody back home seemed to appreciate it. But I do believe that the sacrifices made in Korea by British soldiers as well as by American were not in vain. I think it did serve a purpose.
John Preston Bell.
The things they had done in 50 years to rebuild their country, it impressed me incredibly. And I felt I really wanted to know more about what they had done. I felt very close to the Koreans there. And they were so grateful to us. They really, even now, they treat us like heroes. I wanted to say to them, no, don't thank me. I should be thanking you. You've made it worthwhile. You've made me worthwhile, even my tiny contribution. You've made it worth something. In the biblical sense, you have magnified me. And I was terribly grateful to them. I loved them for that.
John Preston Bell. ABF, the Soldiers' Charity, was established in 1944 to ensure that soldiers returning from the Second World War received the welfare support that had been so lacking at the end of the 1918 war. 77 years on, our central purpose remains the same, safeguarding our soldiers, veterans, and their immediate families so they can live a life of independence and dignity for the service they have given for our freedom and liberty. It is the debt we owe them yesterday, today, and tomorrow. On behalf of ABF, the Soldiers' Charity, to Tommy Clough, John Preston Bell, Sir William Purvis, John Keatley, and George Brown, who so graciously shared their memories for this programme, and their many comrades, whose courage, bravery, and determination in the hard-fought Korean War reminds us that their efforts were certainly neither in vain nor forgotten, we say thank you. Perhaps it is fitting that I close by quoting Pericles, words used by Colonel Sir Guy Lowther when he addressed the 8th Hussars as they left Korea. Each one, man for man, has one imperishable praise. Take these men as for your example. Like them, remember that prosperity can be only for the free, that freedom is the sure possession of those alone who have the courage to defend it. If you'd like to learn more about the work of ABF, the Soldiers' Charity, the national charity of the British Army, please visit soldierscharity.org. With thanks to all those who so kindly contributed, advised and helped with the making of this programme, including Barry De Morgan, Sir Max Hastings, Heathcliff O'Malley, Padre Stephen Whiting, Jenny Redman, Katie Burns and Diane Stradlin. With editing by Steve Campen, this has been a Gamekeeper production for ABF, the Soldiers' Charity.